Hello, welcome to the first episode of Turkey Book Talk in 2018. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. And check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. If you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, consider supporting it through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. The standard pledge is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want, and you can check out details and links to that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. In this latest episode, we speak to Kathy Otten. She's a journalist based in the Kurdistan Regional Government of Northern Iraq and the author of the new book, With Ash on Their Faces, Yazidi Women and the Islamic State, which was published by Or Books. The book is a searing and often harrowing account of the battle for survival of the Yazidis, who were recently targeted in a campaign of genocide at the hands of ISIS after the jihadists brutally overran their historic homeland of Sinjar in August 2014. It's based on over 100 interviews, including with many women who were the victims of serial rape and a system of sexual slavery passed around like cattle at the hands of ISIS fighters in Iraq and Syria. The Yazidis are an ancient religious group rooted in Mesopotamia and have been the target of grim persecution at the hands of various rulers for many centuries. Today they remember a total of 74 separate genocides targeting them throughout their history, with the ISIS campaign just the latest. ISIS fighters were cleared out of Sinjar in November 2015, but the future of the region and of the Yazidis themselves remains shrouded in uncertainty. I started by asking Kathy Otten to talk about the genesis of the book, how and why she decided to write it.
Yeah, sure. So I was already living and working in Iraqi Kurdistan, reporting on these issues. I remember first meeting a Yazidi family in the early part of 2013. They'd come from Aleppo. They were staying in Bashika, actually, near Mosul. And yeah, then a year later, the ISIS attack against Sinjar. I was reporting on the aftermath of that and following it through. Then it wasn't until the next year that actually a more senior journalist, a colleague of mine who'd been hearing me talking about the stories that I'd been reporting on, suggested that I get in touch with a publisher and suggested that it might make a good book. So it's not something that I thought of myself, but the idea kind of came from the reporting that I'd been doing on the subject and really just some quite strong feelings that I had that the way that this issue was being reported was very sensational. And it is a sensational story, so I can understand that. But I felt that perhaps that was at the expense of a deeper understanding of the community, the social, you know, tribal, political dynamics in Sinjar, the reasons why such terrible levels of violence occurred and why this mass rape occurred. I just felt like perhaps there was a deeper story there. There was more to say. And I as well only had to say 800 to 1,000 words when I was doing these news reports about it, and I just felt like the magnitude of the tragedy deserved a little bit more attention. And I also saw that the reporting on the women and the lives of the women, and I'd include myself in this as well, tended to be quite one-dimensional, victimizing. I wanted to try and move away from that. I wanted to present these women as more well-rounded characters. I mean, this is really hard to do as an outsider, and you come across all sorts of problems. It's very difficult reporting in this environment where the people that you're interviewing are very disempowered, are very vulnerable. So there's all sorts of like ethical questions as well. So it was quite a complex process, but that was my aim.
And I want to address that reporting process a bit later on, but I think maybe before that, we should kind of set the scene, really, by giving kind of as broad an overview as possible. Could you just kind of summarize, really, like, who are the Yazidis? What's happened to them over the years? They're this ancient community, really, that's lived in this part of mainly northern Iraq for millennia, really. It's a history full of tragedy, really. Could you just kind of tell that story and kind of narrate it up to when ISIS emerged a few years ago?
Yeah, the Yazidis are a people, they worship a religion with really, really ancient roots, some say going back to the Sumerians, but certainly heavily influenced and related to pre-Zoroastrian, East Iranian religions, Mithraism, traditions, things like that. And these kind of worships, these practices revolving around rites to do with sun worship, nature, were continuing in the mountains between Iran and Iraq. The Kurdish tribes that lived around there. And they were influenced by a 12th century Sufi mystic called Sheikh Adi, who came from the Bekaa Valley in what's now Lebanon. He went to Baghdad and then established a Sufi order in the mountains of northern Iraq, which is where Lalish is now, where he's buried. And this is the Yazidi holy center, a very, very important place, like Mecca for them. And Sheikh Adi's mystical teachings really influenced the people that were living around Lalish at that time. And so you had this kind of fusing of these more ancient pre-Islamic religious practices with the influence of Sufism. Over time, the devotees of Sheikh Adi became like more and more renegade in their interpretation of Islam and were cast out of the Islamic community. And that's really the genesis of the attacks against them. You know, the religion has all these sorts of strains and heavily influenced, you know, there's baptism rites, there's influences from Islam, relations to Zoroastrianism. And it was this mixture, this renegade element that meant that they were persecuted. I mean, again and again and again throughout their history in Lalish. And there's countless tales that members of the community retell, because this was an oral religion until very recently, about attacks, persecutions. You know, they lived on the fringes of the Ottoman Empire. Sinjar Mountain was a place where they could try and escape the taxation, forced conversion, the capture of their women. And then fast forward to 2014, that's where they were also attacked by ISIS. And in the book, I try to talk about some of the recent socio-political history of Sinjar, because I find that very interesting, going from the 1970s to the present day. But yeah, that's the broad overview.
And the population, I think, is there's 1 million living in northern Iraq at the moment, and then many, of course, elsewhere in the world. Is that right?
I'm not sure of the exact population, but it's less than a million worldwide. Right. It's a very, very small group, partly to do with really strict marriage practices. Northern Iraq, I'd say less than 500,000, around half a million. There were 300,000 to 400,000 Yazidis living in around Sinjar at the time of the ISIS attack. And then you have smaller communities in the Caucasus. You did have Yazidis living in southeast of Turkey, but I don't believe there are many left. There were some Yazidis in Syria no longer, but there's a large population in Germany and then some in the US and Australia.
And as you were kind of touched on there, they were targeted over generations, really, because of this popular belief, actually, that they're devil worshippers, because they worship this bird. And that was, that being the case, you know, ISIS with its jihadi ideology in particular saw the Yazidis as a target when it emerged. This is kind of a really bad interpretation of the Yazidi beliefs. But how did that stereotype emerge?
Yeah, because they worship the peacock angel, which is like the demiurge, or the representative of God on earth. It's a very important figure for them. And he is the chief of seven angels, who are very important in the Yazidi creation story. But there is a likeness in the story of the peacock angel in their creation myths to the devil in other religions, in Islam and in Christianity. So that's where that came from. But of course, for the Yazidis, he's not the devil. So this has been a misinterpretation, and one that's caused a lot of strife for the community. But I would say that even though, yes, many of the attacks were by Muslim rulers over the last centuries, also like crude Orientalist stereotypes about the Yazidis being devil worshippers were also propagated by Western colonial travelers, missionaries, attempts to convert Yazidis to Christianity. Yeah, and a lot of the earlier accounts are, as you can imagine, really full of like racist stereotypes and strange accusations of them being secretive or things like this.
And when ISIS emerged, really in 2014, it was really hitting international headlines. And the area around Sinjar was really the focus of a lot of media attention internationally at the time. And that was partly because there was this very visceral kind of human drama where Yazidis were chased away from the town of Sinjar, and they headed up Sinjar Mountain and were kind of trapped there. And there were airlifts going in there, but really it was a horrific humanitarian situation with tens of thousands of Yazidis surrounded by ISIS militants. That obviously, there was terrible massacres that were committed. And then very quickly, one of the things that people realized in the months afterwards was that many of the Yazidi women were being taken into slavery, sexual slavery. Mm. And ISIS basically set up this almost industrial slave market, which you describe in the book, very disturbing, but very sensitively. I just wonder if you could kind of talk about how that emerged and kind of describe some of the horrors, really, that are at the center of this book, and the kind of the effect that it had on the local population.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, it was obvious to the people involved very quickly that their women and girls were missing. But I think it took a while for these stories to kind of come out and for people to start to actually understand the scale of what happened. So it's thought to be 6,000 or maybe even more than 6,000 women and children that were taken. And then they were moved very rapidly. And this is why the UN in particular has called it a genocide. And said that the ISIS fighters went in there with a pre-planned, with intentions to carry out this mass enslavement, because they had vehicles, they were able to transport large numbers of Yazidi women and children as like spoils of battle. They were taken initially to places like Badj, south of Sinjar, which was a hotbed for Al-Qaeda after 2003. They were taken to Talafa, again, like really strong ISIS presence in Talafa. Lots of ISIS leaders come from that area. It's thought that the initial attacks on Sinjar were planned from Talatha and from Hasaka in eastern Syria as well. So I think the terrifying thing about this is, or was, how organized the capture of these people was and how methodical the killings were. And these stories that I heard during the reporting, you just hear the same details over and over again from different people, which just creates this really eerie, horrible sense of just absolute tragedy and confusion. Now, there are some videos as well floating around from that morning in Sinjar, and you really get a sense of just like absolute chaos. Lots of people didn't know what was happening. Some of the Yazidis even greeted the ISIS fighters, like smiling and waving, you know, in towns on the north side of the mountain, because they didn't quite know what was going on. That was in a town called Hardan, which I focus on in part of the book. But yeah, the women and children were taken off and were basically treated like animals, and young girls were sold and locked away in houses. Awful torture and abuse, as you can imagine. A lot of some of the older women who had 4, 5, 6 maybe young children kept in these underground prisons in Raqqa. So the young, more attractive girls would be sold first, and many of them, you know, stayed there for a year or more and were sold every month or two to different ISIS fighters, sold on auctions. Some of the older women were forced to do housework. A lot of children have completely disappeared, actually. Some have found their way back. Some children have forgotten who they are, who have forgotten Kurdish and now speaking Arabic, were trained as some of the imams with ISIS or fighters sent to front lines. So you have this really disorientating also like problem of identity, and especially for younger kids and younger teenagers. Who am I? Some of them who've returned might not trust their parents, or, you know, just have this really fundamental confusion about who they are and what's going on, which I think is not quite understood by people on the outside, just how psychologically traumatizing that is. And then also for the men in the community as well, there's been big shifts in Yazidi culture towards accepting the women back, which has been really difficult for Yazidi men as well. And I think sometimes their tragedy ideas forgotten in this as well. You know, it's a culture with a strong sense of honor, so shame has been a big problem. And what also something that I touch on in the book is the continuing displacement of the people, politicized displacement in Iraq, which has been really hard. So you have women and young girls coming back incredibly angry and incredibly traumatized from this just like industrialized sexual assault that they've lived through, trying to get used to coming home to family really hard, and then in camps it's just awful with people still missing. So it's a really sad, tragic situation. And I think another point that I would say is a lot of people might focus on the ISIS use of rape as a specific example of them as monsters, which I mean I think in one way is true, but I also wanted to get away from that stereotype of ISIS as pure evil, and I wanted to, I don't know, just try and show how actually this can happen. And it's, I do see it as kind of an extension of the misogyny that we all deal with worldwide as females. And I think we're seeing these stories coming out in the media now about sexual harassment and abuse. And okay, this, what happened to the Yazidis in Iraq and Syria with ISIS was on a different level and in a different context, but I think we can see some threads, some strands of similarity about what happens when women are completely subjugated and when male power runs amok and violent power.
And as you describe in this story, that you actually spoke to, you made more than 100 interviews with victims, more than 100 victims. So it's a really massive undertaking. And you kind of distilled it into a 200-page book. I mean, how did you go about approaching this kind of very intimidatingly large and tragic subject and kind of condensing it into this very sharply written book?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it was incredibly intimidating. I'd already been covering this issue as a journalist, so I already knew a lot of people in the community, which really helped. I was already living in the country and I'd been here throughout everything that happened with ISIS. So, of course, that was a head start. But just still, the scale of the project and the subject matter was really daunting. And I'd never written a book before and didn't know anybody who'd written a book. So I just went straight into it and embarked on, I think probably it was about 7 months of just traveling around Yazidi areas with Yazidi friends of mine, and just visiting people and talking to them, trying to be very transparent about the aims of my project, because I do think there are issues in the camps here in Iraq where sometimes Yazidi, especially women who've escaped from ISIS, might be visited by journalists and not quite understand that the journalist isn't there to help them, it's not an NGO worker. So, you know, there is some slipperiness there. So I tried to be very straight, spend time with people and get to know them. And then it quickly became apparent, like through those visits, who was actually comfortable talking to me and telling me their story and who wasn't. So that was just quite an instinctual process. You know, some people like to talk and describe what happened to them and are able to do so. Some people just aren't. And I think that goes for other types of journalism as well and to other subject matters. Yeah, and I think it was just a very intense experience. I remember having nightmares at the time while I was doing that reporting and coming out for 2 weeks, and just sort of a lot of the book came out at that point from these interviews that I'd been doing. And then I went back and did a lot more reporting into the kind of political dynamics, into the history. Yeah, the military stuff came and went. That was dependent on offensives that were happening. Some of that I'd already done. Some of that came later. I did a whole chunk on Sinjar Mountain with the different Kurdish groups that are up there. And then I had to go away and write it and put it all together, which took a while. It was like a jigsaw puzzle.
And these are women who you speak to in many cases are still going through trauma. I mean, they've been through some absolutely terrible things that you describe in the book of being kind of passed around like cattle. It really is very upsetting to read at times. But the way that some of them open up as well is remarkable. And I was thinking almost as I read it that there's almost no way that a man could report this kind of thing, because there's no way that they could inspire the kind of confidence among these women in what is still a very conservative and introspective community. I wonder if you kind of reflected on that as you were writing, you know, that this really could only be reported by a woman.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent that's true. Although I did, as an outsider, as a non-Yazidi, I think that also created a barrier that made it difficult. And having to go through translation as well, because I do understand a bit of Kurdish, but definitely not enough to rely on that on its own. You know, the Yazidis speaking Kurmanji Kurdish. So I was working with female Yazidi translators when I was doing the interviews with these women. And I think that really helped, because they were not only translating, these Yazidi females I was working with are, very smart in their own right and very interesting and able to explain some of the cultural complexities or uses of language and idioms that I might not necessarily understand. So that was really helpful. But I think there were still barriers there. Yes, I do think it helped as a woman, definitely. I mean, it's hard for me to say because I don't have the experience of being a male journalist, but I do think that anyway, when you're talking about these things, often euphemisms are used. Like, they will say, he did the bad thing to me instead of rape, or he forced me to marry. So yeah, I think the people that I interviewed, I expect they would be uncomfortable speaking about that with a man. But not only, I think just because I'm a female journalist, it doesn't make it comfortable, you know, it doesn't make it an easy experience. And I tried to be very sensitive to that, because I certainly didn't want to re-traumatize anybody. So that was quite difficult.
And there's something else that you mentioned in the book as well about how the Yazidi community is, of course, it's very tightly knit. And one of the reasons why it's such a grave situation for them is that they can be kind of outcast from the community. It's one of the reasons why rape elsewhere is used as a kind of weapon of war. And it really wasn't that clear for a long time whether the women who have been subjected to these horrors would actually be accepted back into the community afterwards. And they didn't know themselves either at the time. And that's one of the many reasons why this was so horrific. Could you just kind of talk a bit about that aspect, those kind of intercommunal dynamics, really?
Yeah, so I think one of the reasons that ISIS used this was as a way to try and wipe out this community, and more than just by killing the men, because the Yazidis have these strict rules about not being able to marry outside. And in the past, there was a famous case of an honor killing of a Yazidi girl who ran away with a Sunni Arab guy. So actually, the Yazidi community did react to accept these women quite quickly. I remember that actually myself, at the end of the month after the ISIS attack happened, two of the first girls that managed to escape, actually from Fallujah in Anbar province, came back, and they were immediately accepted. I mean, I don't want to paint a wholly rosy picture of it. It is an incredibly important step that's been taken, but that doesn't mean that it's been easy for all the women and girls that have returned. And some actually conversations I've been having with Yazidis as part of the diaspora, because I've been in Germany doing a book tour recently, and there's lots of Yazidis living there. You know, some people are talking about how the traditions of Yazidis not being able to marry outside their religion or outside the caste to which they belong, and there's three castes, and how that's actually causing problems and holding the religion back. So some younger Yazidis are now saying, we need to relax these rules, and not just for women that have been forced to convert and have had these awful things happen to them, that this exception was made, but there are calls within the community to kind of loosen up those strictures and not only have it as an exception. But it certainly did help the women and girls that came back, and when some of them heard about it when they were in captivity, it made a big difference to them, absolutely.
And one of the other reasons, of course, apart from the sensitivity of the reporting that you were doing, presumably at the time ISIS was still active, you know, in northern Iraq, and there were areas that were kind of no-go areas, and many Yazidis, I think, were still in captivity at the time that you were doing the reporting, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, a lot of Yazidis are still missing.
Yeah.
I think the last figure that I saw was over 2,000. That's women and children. I mean, a lot of men are still missing as well, because the mass graves that surround Sinjar haven't properly been exhumed because they're on this disputed territory line. And we've seen clashes between the Kurdistan regional government and Baghdad recently. So Sinjar, as it was pre-2014, and I try and point this out in the book, you know, the Yazidis living along this trigger line, as the Americans used to call it, this disputed territory area actually made them really vulnerable. And these same problematic political dynamics are still going on now. And one of the results of that is that the mass graves haven't been exhumed because it's not safe, because international organizations can't go there. It's very difficult to access Sinjar at the moment. So we don't really know how many people are in those graves, and there are still many people missing. You know, there was a conversion experiment where ISIS kept a lot of Yazidis alive, living with their families around Tel Afar in the early part of the enslavement. And this was, it had the redolence of like Nazi Germany era experimentations during that genocide, because what we saw was ISIS trying to see if this forced conversion of the Yazidis did work. So the Yazidis that did agree to convert were not killed, were taken to Tel Afar, forced to work for ISIS. But then there was a point where lots of them were escaping and the Peshmerga got closer, and this experimentation was deemed to fail. And then a lot of Yazidis just went missing, like families just didn't hear from them again after that. So there are big question marks about what happened to those Yazidis. And as far as I know, it's not clear. So I think that more mass graves will be discovered. And yes, there are Yazidis still missing, still in captivity. This is the point of bitterness for the community, that they feel that the war against ISIS has been fought solely for territorial gains. This is with the coalition and the Iraqi forces and others. Instead of having the aims of rescuing the women and girls, they feel like these female lives weren't seen as valuable enough, that there were times when they could have been rescued and they weren't, that wasn't the focus of the intervention. So yeah, and that's correct what you say. Like when I was reporting it, ISIS was still very much a factor. Actually, I spent most of the last year reporting on the battle for Mosul, but before that, Sinjar was still a dangerous place to go. Now it's free of ISIS, but it's still very insecure for the kind of second tier conflicts that we're seeing occurring between the victors, really, between the different militias that managed to rid the area of ISIS. So you find that the same political security dynamics that contributed before to the conflict and created security vacuums still exist now after ISIS.
And in Sinjar, I just wonder if we could talk about the current situation in Sinjar. I mean, have many civilians moved back there, and how much damage has been done really to the kind of material landscape in the town?
Well, yeah, Sinjar city itself was completely destroyed, which was really sad because I was never there beforehand, but by all accounts, it was a very interesting, very beautiful place, you know, right by the Syrian border, the northwest of Iraq, underneath Sinjar Mountain. You know, you had like the remains of a 4th century Roman fort there, but you also have Shia shrines and different types of mosques, and you had an Armenian church there, different Christian communities, as well as Yazidis and Shia and Sunni Muslims and Turkmen and Arabs. So really interesting, diverse material history as well as in terms of society, but that's all gone, which is a great shame. Really complicated social dynamics there. The Yazidis mainly lived in the towns and villages surrounding Sinjar. Many of those witnessed massive destruction as well. A lot of Yazidis have actually gone back recently. It's been slow trickles and different waves. So you had some people going back to the north side of the mountain after the Peshmerga liberated that. That was at the end of 2014. The end of 2015 was the offensive that retook Sinjar. I was on that myself. And that was basically, there was very little actual fighting on that offensive. It was mainly the city was just destroyed by coalition airstrikes the night before. I remember because I was sleeping in the hills and trying to sleep amid all the pounds of these huge bombs falling on the city. And then the Kurdish troops just swept in the next day, and ISIS had mostly already run away. They were sending in the odd mortar. And yeah, unfortunately, the town is destroyed. Some people have gone back, but I've not been there for a while, and now it's very difficult to get there after this recent fighting between Baghdad and KRG and these recent tensions. But actually, strangely enough, a lot of Yazidis went back. And when I say went back, it's because because most of them are living in the camps around Duhok, before the recent referendum on independence, the KRG. And I was speaking to Yazidi friends around that time, and I think it was just out of a real worry about insecurity, which is actually borne out to be correct. It would be important to add, though, that most Yazidis still don't feel safe living in Iraq and are trying to leave. I don't think I have any Yazidi friends who aren't trying to leave.
In Sinjar, from looking at it from Turkey, Sinjar has now started to kind of appear in Turkish news reports because there are all these kind of concerns among government people warning kind of darkly about a second PKK headquarters emerging in Sinjar, because a lot of Yazidis have gone to fight for PKK-aligned groups. But obviously Sinjar is also kind of struggled over, as you say, by Baghdad and the KRG and also the PKK for influence. And people are kind of warning about a second kind of PKK headquarters is being set up there in addition to Kandil, which is also in northern Iraq. Kind of in control there really at the moment, if anybody?
Yeah, it does seem like just for this moment there's a bit of a security vacuum going on from what I've heard. As I said, I've not been there for a while. But you basically have the Yazidis under the Hashid or the Popular Mobilization Forces who are in control of most areas around Sinjar now. And that changed recently because before it was the Peshmerga. So the security dynamic keeps shifting. But actually a lot of those Yazidis that joined the PKK early on have now switched to joining Yazidi groups under the Hashid. So that's as well been another change. So I think actually I'd feel more comfortable saying this if I'd actually been on the ground there recently, but it seems to be my impression from conversations that I've had that the PKK have lost some power and influence there. And I certainly know that some of the high up commanding PKK figures that were on the mountain for a considerable portion of time and directing operations, some of them now have gone back to Kandil. But I think that the Sinjar area is very important for the PKK, operating as a kind of fallback from Rojava, from the Kurdish enclave in northern Syria. And something I talk about in the book as well, the Sinjar area has always been really important for smuggling. Like the people that control those border areas, which were dissected when the country's border lines were drawn at the end of the British mandate, go through these Arab tribal lands, but it's really been who holds the border also is able to make a lot of money out of smuggling, and that's been oil, cigarette, sheep, Al-Qaeda fighters. Yeah, so I'd say that that's one reason why it's important to the PKK and whoever, for all the actors, it's a very strategic place. So it does seem as if the PKK power in that area is waning, but because the security situation is changing so rapidly, I almost feel as if, which is often the case in northern Iraq, like any time you make a judgment, it's liable to completely shift and change the next day. And I would also say that with the Yazidis, I think it really was a kind of alliance of convenience for them joining the PKK. Even though Yazidis have been members of the PKK going back, they've had an older relationship. But the way I saw it myself, and didn't make myself popular in Germany saying this with a few members of the audience during some of my book readings, but I don't think that the PKK has been a natural fit with the traditional Yazidi culture in Sinjar. Some very different things, for example, the role of women. So yeah, I don't think that story's over. Not quite seen what's going to be the outcome there.
That was Kathy Otten. Many thanks to her. Check out armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com for a link to my review in Hurriyet Daily News of the book. There you'll also be able to find links to a few of the most recent articles Kathy has published on the Yazidis and related subjects, including a piece she published last month for The Atlantic on practical changes the Yazidi religion has undergone as a result of the tumult over the last few years. Remember, you can support this podcast via my Patreon account, making a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. Many thanks to my current Patreon supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jan Marcus Vommel, Steve Bryant, Aaron Ataman, Max Hoffman, Andrew McDowell, Paul Levin, Tan Tunala, and Ayla Jean Yakli. If you want to join them, you can find links to that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. Also, please do rate or review the podcast on whatever platform you listen on, which hugely helps increase awareness of it for other potential listeners. You can also follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and do email with any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, once again, thank you very much for listening.